Okay, now, having a fear of taking vows, having a fear of taking vows is having a fear of committing to doing something good. Why? We may know our habits. We may know we're greedy. We may know we're lazy. We may know that we're a procrastinator. We may know that we're someone that makes excuses. We may know that we're someone that just doesn't want to push ourselves to make an effort. So we are afraid of taking vows. But there's a positive side. People who are afraid of taking vows and commitments, they're actually very good. Why? They're actually people that when they take it, they will hold it. Why? If they didn't have the vows and commitments in high regard, they wouldn't be afraid. They just sit there and go, okay, whatever, I won't do this, I won't do that, I won't do the vows over. And the next day, they're back to normal exactly as they are. So people who are actually afraid of taking vows, the way to approach them is not to scold them, or to tell them off, or tell them how stupid and silly they are. The way to approach them is to explain why they're afraid, from whence the fear comes from, why they shouldn't be afraid. Why? Because they respect it so much, that's why they're afraid. That's why they're afraid. Sometimes when we go to court, they make them, in the US, they make you swear on the Bible. After they swear, some people are very afraid because they're God-fearing. Some people, they don't care, they're whatever. They don't care. So what happens is, taking vows is something very personal. It is a commitment that we feel that I want to make a change. I want to do something about myself. I want to make a vow. And I'm not going to swear December 31st, midnight. How many New Year's resolutions have we made? New Year's resolutions don't work. Do you know why? Because they don't commit to anything or anyone. There's nothing there to hold us. But when we commit to a Buddha, when we commit to God, or we commit to Buddha, in this case, let's say Buddha, we feel there's a bigger pull and there's a more holy pull. Why? If we can prostrate in front of the Buddha and collect merits, if we can do meditations on the Buddha and we can achieve inner growth, then definitely doing something detrimental to a Buddha, although he won't get us back, there will be detrimental results because we have made a promise in front of something that can grant something positive, but we twisted it around. So therefore, some people say, well, then I won't take a vow. If you don't take a vow, for real practitioners, if you don't take a vow, there's no basis for any of attainments to arise. No attainments. You think it's no big deal if I don't have any attainments arise. I'll take care of my family, I'll take care of my work, I'll take care of this, I'll take care of that. After that, I'll take vows and maybe I'll get attainments. Most likely not. People who wait till they're older, or people who wait till all commitments are finished, either way, usually are not very good vow holders. I'll tell you why. Their habituation of a lifetime is too strong. Very, very strong. Secondly, those type of people, they've trained their minds to focus or think in a certain way. It's very hard to break that. Very, very hard. I mean, how can you be thinking about money, 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 making money, 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 money for 30 years, and all of a sudden you just say, I take a vow and I stop. I'll be committed. Definitely not. I haven't seen that yet. Most likely not. How come for 30 years you think about, oh, I want to get a beautiful, fabulous partner. Partner. All of a sudden, when you're 40 or 50, you say, oh, I don't want partners anymore. I want to take vows. A, there might be something medically wrong with you, so you have no choice to take the vows, right? I don't know. Or B, you've been disappointed. But it doesn't mean it was a good reason why you took the vows. So people who usually wait till their commitments are finished, even when they take the vows, because so much time has been wasted and the learning capability becomes less, even when they take the vows, even if they recognize something wrong that they need to correct or make better, it's very, very difficult. Why is it very difficult? A lifetime of habituation. And that lifetime of habituation that I've spoken about before in previous talks is a trigger, an environmental trigger to many previous lives dispositions that open up in this life. So many previous lives, all we've been interested was to chase money or chase wealth or chase for food or appearances, if we've always been interested after many lifetimes and previous lives, this life, the minute we get into that habit, is very hard to break. Why is that very hard to break? Because this lifetime of being in it for so many years triggers many, 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 many lifetimes of being into it. So therefore, the hard habit becomes even more double hard to break. So to wait to take the vows is quite dangerous. Why? We may not be able to. Physically, we may not be able to handle it. How much practice can we actually do later on? And also, instead of fighting the habituations we have now, it will be compounded year after year after year after year after year. So we have many years of compounded habituation. Even some people have taken the vow. Some people have taken it in very holy places, very holy lamas, but those people, myself included, should check themselves. Since I've taken my refuge vows up till now, has my spiritual practice increased? Has my time for spiritual practice increased? Can I do spiritual practice without people prompting me, pushing me, negotiating with me, or begging me, cajoling me, bribing me, or threatening me? Will I do the spiritual practice on my own, or I still need the outer support? If you've taken spiritual vows, and you still need people to prompt and push and prompt and push and prompt and push you, and you see no results yourself, then you know what category you fall into. If you know you fall into that category, you must expect the results of falling into that category. There's no omnipotent deity out there that punishes you or rewards you. It comes from your own actions and its results. If there was an omnipotent deity who actually punishes, then all people who do wrongdoings would be punished, and we would not need rule of law. None. If there was an omnipotent deity that actually rewards us, then we have seen in our lives many people that were very good, but got the short end of the stick, or suffered tremendously. And we can talk it away by saying it's mysterious, or we don't really understand what's going on. There's nothing to understand because it's based on illogic. There's nothing to understand. It's totally illogic. If there's an omnipotent deity that controls, that manipulates and maneuvers all workings of beings, then there should definitely be no suffering. No suffering at all. There should be no problems. And everybody who is born must be born equally the same. Everybody who is born must be the same and equal, with the same head start. You can't be a father and mother and have five kids. Three kids you give a big amount. One kid you give a small amount, and one kid you give nothing. And then you say, well, whatever happens in the end, it's up to you. You can't have one kid that's handicapped or blind and deaf, and then the other kid, all his faculties are totally all right. And then they go out, and one doesn't make it, still depends on mommy and daddy, and the other one has made it. And you say, see, you're a loser, you're not. If there's an omnipotent deity, there will be none of that. None of that. How can there be? And then, if we're giving free choice, if we are given free choice, and we can choose and pick as we like, how can we have free choice when we're born in a jungle somewhere, naked, running around with spears, with bones going through our noses and our ears? And we eat our neighbors because, you know, they got on our nerves. Personally, I wouldn't eat people who got on my nerves. I'd throw them out. But anyways, think about that. So if you're born somewhere in some jungle, naked, with spears, with bones through your noses, and no one's taught you how to have correct freedom of thinking, and you just do as you like, then if your whole life passes in negativity, killing and murder and rape, slaughtering, aggression and fighting and burning other villages, and your whole life has passed in that, then do you go to hell? If you go to hell, whose fault is that? Who put you there in the first place? Who put you in that situation? They say, well, you had free will. That's not fair. If you're born next to a temple or a church and they teach you what's right and wrong, that's fair, right? But if you're born out in some jungle and no one's ever seen you, and you don't know that civilization exists, and civilization doesn't know you exist, then if you do all these things, you go to hell. simply because you don't know doesn't make sense to me. Illogical, unfair. So therefore, it would have to be a different type of thinking. That other thinking must be based on action. Action that we do. And those bring results. And therefore, because each one of us is unique and different, and each one of us create different types of actions, that would very logically surmise that it creates different results. And therefore, all of us have different types of results. Example, if we lie a lot, and we say things that are not true, and we say things that always for our own advantage to cover our faults, and we lie again and again and again. It is said, by the power of lying, one will always be around friends that deceive one. One will always be with partners and people that deceive and that trick and that use us. One second is our, when we speak, it will have no power. People will not listen. And people will not take credence, or people will not take any type of weight in what we say due to lying. An accumulation of lying can result in us being mute in future lives. Mute, unable to speak or talk. At this level, 100% we say, oh yes, that's it. Difficult for most of us. We need some type of penetrative wisdom. We need some meditation. But for most of us, we can think, that makes more sense. That makes more sense because why? Then you have to take responsibility for yourself. And therefore, when people harm you, A, you've created the causes in previous lives and this life for harm to come. And so when you're in that situation, an environmental cause opens up, and therefore that harm can come to you. Because why is some of us always deceived? Why is some of us not deceived? Why some of us talk and it has a lot of power, and some of us talk and it doesn't? What can be the cause of that? Because there's an omnipotent God pulling strings? Or is it that it is self-created? If we think that it's self-created, whether at this point it is self-created or not, doesn't matter. Never mind. Whether at this point it is self-created or not, it doesn't matter. Why? Because this type of theory and thought makes us take responsibility and let go of anger. How does it make us take responsibility and let go of anger? How? Because if we have created the karma to receive this type of result, the ultimate author and doer was ourselves. So everybody else was just caught in the crossfire of the opening of our karma, or the ripening of our results. A. So that way, when we think about it, we can let go. That's why His Holiness the Dalai Lama says, on that type of thinking and basis, we can let go of a lot of anger. Then you're thinking, but that might be right, that might be wrong. It doesn't matter at this point whether it's right or wrong. At this point, it is important to diffuse anger, to diffuse the way we react with others, to diffuse negative actions that might arise from anger. That's what's important right now. And so how do we diffuse something like anger? How do we diffuse? We diffuse it by having a different perspective. If we're brought up in a philosophy that says, you harm me, I must get revenge on you to have honor, and we're fed that, then it doesn't end. I get you, you get me, I get you, you get me, I get you, and it can go for generations. And it can spread to villages, it can spread to different provinces and cities, it can spread to different nations, and the nations can be at war and fighting all the time. Why? Because there's this kind of thinking and philosophy, I get you, you get me. But if you had this kind of thinking that the actions that I experience has a cause, if you work, then you will move up in your company. You have an action that results in a cause. So therefore, People who don't work hard in company, who move up because they're relatives of the boss, they don't do well in their positions. Even if they get those positions, they don't do very well. So my point is, if you realize that you're the author and you're the cause of what's happening to you, if you realize that, a whole different perspective, a whole different view, and a whole different type of mind arises. Then you think to yourself even more deeper, wait a minute, if I'm the cause of it, then I can remove it. If I can remove it, let me learn how. And that would be a very good reason to engage in spiritual practice. That would be a very good reason to adopt a religious path. That would be an excellent reason for taking refuge or for taking vows. So therefore, if we think that we are the author, now let's investigate further. How is that? Action. Preceded by motivation. Preceded by thought. What kind of thought? Thought that is habitual. This thought results in action. This action results in result. Then the result comes back. And it goes round and round and round. We can talk about prayer. We can talk about meditation. We can talk about reciting mantras. We can talk about going to a sacred place and doing pujas. We can talk about all that. Those are all supplementary. Going to a church, going to a temple, listening to Dharma talks or ceremonies, taking refuge or doing practices or meditations and prayers, those are really wonderful, but those are only supplementary. They're supplementary to what? To learning. Only supplementary. Why? The only way we can transform to change the reality around us is by knowing the method. The only way we can know the method is we learn. And the only way we can learn is from someone or a being who's achieved that state of mind. That state of mind is called enlightenment. And that has to be a Buddha. There are male Buddhas, there are female Buddhas. It isn't just a historical Shakyamuni. Buddhahood is a state of mind. It's a title given to someone who's achieved that level. For example, prime minister. A prime minister can be that of any country. It doesn't have to be just this wonderful country. It can be any country when you say prime minister. So when we refer to Buddha, it means any enlightened being. Any enlightened being. So therefore, we have fear of taking vows because we fear we'll lose freedom. But that's wrong thinking. Actually, we don't have freedom. We really don't have freedom. None of us. It's only some of us take it for granted. Some of us think about it more. Some of us don't think about it more. We all don't have freedom. We don't have freedom from catastrophes. We don't have freedom from aging. We don't have freedom from physical deterioration. We don't have any freedom from illness and sickness. We don't have any freedom from financial disasters. We don't have any freedom from our anger. We don't have freedom from our jealousies and our attachments. We don't have any freedom from our gluttony. We don't have any freedom from desiring sleep. We don't have any freedom from greed. Actually, we don't have any freedom. People think we have freedom because they don't know any better, but they don't have freedom. Why? When we engage in those actions, there's not a god or a lama or a father or a priest that tells you, oh, bad, bad, good, good. Whether there's a person telling you good or bad, those actions will create negative circumstances for us. Understanding them and not understanding them makes no difference. Why does it make no difference? Because they are inherently negative. Inherently. Things that are not inherently negative, for example, drinking. Drinking alcohol, surprisingly, yes, is not inherently negative. Engaging in copulation is not inherently negative. Wanting to wear nice clothes is not inherently negative. Shouting is not inherently negative. For example, a mother who loves a child and uses forceful means to train the child because it's very stubborn. Shouting. All these actions are not inherently negative. Inherently negative actions are whether they do negative to others or bring negative results to yourself and others directly and without having to think anything. Example, killing. Killing is inherently negative. It, from its own side, is negative. So whether an animal kills another animal knowingly or not knowingly, there's karma involved. Whether a human being kills with premeditation or not, there's karma involved. The leverage or the strength of the karma is dependent on the motivation. It's dependent on the motivation. But killing is inherently negative. Cheating on one's spouse is inherently negative. There is no justification in any way, shape, or form. It's inherently negative. Why is it inherently negative? Very simple. It creates pain. It creates pain in others. It creates pain in people you care or people that care about you. And it creates pain in yourself. Why? Because you habituate yourself to do more and more, creating more pain for other people. It's inherently negative. So when we cheat on our spouse, it's inherently negative action. Inherently related to the body. There are three negativities of the body that to be avoided when we take refuge. And one of them is cheating on our spouse. Now, if we're not married, and the people we run around with is not married, and then we engage in copulation with them, I'm not saying it's okay, but it's not inherently negative. Don't say, oh my God, you know, on the way out, I pass out condoms or something. No, I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about inherent negative or positive. So if you don't have a partner, and the people you're engaged with doesn't have a partner, and you guys are together, that's up to two consenting adults. So whether your consenting partner, the fact is, no one is hurt in this practice. No one is hurt. No one gets damaged, and that's very important. Some cultures believe that women don't matter. That women are there to just bring pleasure. And that women, doesn't matter if they get hurt. That's the way it should be. In Buddhism, they don't believe in that. And they don't respect that. And they don't agree with that. As I've explained before, definitely not in Buddhism. Why? Buddhism doesn't look at the sex of the person. Buddhism looks at the mind of the person and whether the mind is damageable or not. It can receive pain. That's it. So since the mind can receive pain in Buddhism, male and female are equal. Equal. As I've explained before, in Tibet, it's very common for women to have two or three or four husbands. Very common. Men cannot, women can. Definitely cannot. Men. And women can divorce men anytime and receive half the property. That's very common in Tibet. You see, in Tibetan Buddhism, female energy is very much admired and respected. Very much. That comes from the philosophy of not bringing harm. And females are considered a little more kinder than males because they're able to produce and carry and use their body in such a way that brings a lot of pain to themselves but give life to others. So they're very much respected for that. Very, very much. It's a matriarchal society. And that's based on Buddhism. So therefore, if we have a partner or we're with a partner, whether you're with 100 partners or you're with one partner, the criteria is this. There's no moral rock throwing here, can, cannot. The criteria is very simple, and you take responsibility. When I engage with this person, do I harm them or myself? That's subjective, isn't it? Some people say yes, if you run around with 100 people and you're, you know, having a good time with 100 people, one a day, it's harmful to yourself. I mean, that's subjective. You can catch diseases and all that stuff, definitely. You can pass diseases. But my point is, we're talking about karma now. I want to focus on that. And so, if you're with another partner, see, religion or conservative types of Buddhism says, oh, cannot, 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 that's bad, you do this, cannot. But look carefully. Who in this world, in a modern world, can just throw everything aside? Shave off the hair, okay, maybe one. Shave off the hair and go into a mountain. They say, okay, no good food, no sex. I'm not going to get angry. I'm not even going to wear my glasses because, you know, I'm not attached anymore, so it doesn't matter if I can see in front of me or not. I'm not going to wear any nice clothes. I just wear a potato sack. And it doesn't matter whether it's hot or cold. I'm going to hang out in the cave because I'm not attached, and I'm going to meditate on Tsongkhapvan and recite his mantra until I'm enlightened. Or bust. Probably bust. Who can do that? It's impossible. So we have to find the middle way. People do have desire. People do need fulfillment at this level. People do need company. They need food. They need a nice place to stay. They need socialization. They need that. So if you say cannot, it's either can or cannot. What you have is a lot of guilt factor. You create relations that create a lot of guilt and a lot of fear and a lot of you're going to go to hell. And we don't need that. We have enough guilt. We have enough guilt. There's an American saying, you must have a Jewish mother. They say, yes, I feel very guilty. But that should be a compliment because Jewish women are wonderful. Or a Chinese mother, that's a new thing too. They're kind of similar. But what's my point? My point is we have enough guilt. We don't need more guilt. So if we want to engage in intercourse with someone, we have to think, will this harm? We think, no, it doesn't harm. I don't know, whatever like that. Then there should be no harm. But to say no or nothing, it's unhealthy. Why is it unhealthy? Because we're not with us. We're not the Virgin Mary. And what's with that Virgin Mary anyway? How can you be a virgin and have a baby? But never mind. I think it's more symbolic. She's very pure and clean. I think it's more like that. And anyway, why are you pure and clean if you're a virgin? These days, if you're a virgin, they go, you are you. Doesn't make sense. What we need is something logical. So therefore, if you're going to engage in a partner and it doesn't harm the other person, it's okay. And in the spirit of Buddhism also, and you can use this for every example. But we're going to talk about this because we like to talk about sex. You like to hear it, and I like to talk about it, and it's legal because we're in front of the Buddha. And none of them are giving us any evil faces. So they're all happy, they're all smiling, and you're smiling, and I'm smiling, so we must be on the right path. We talk about things that we don't dare ever talk about in the church or temple, no, especially in Asia. Sex? You cannot talk about that. Oh, sex. It's not inherently bad. It depends on the motivation. So therefore, if you don't harm the other person, you can do things with them. You can do whatever you like. You can do it the normal way. You can buy leather. You can wear construction clothes. You can buy the stewardess outfit for your friend. Make her wear the stewardess outfit, although she doesn't want to, but you beg her, so it's all right. You can do it with, if you're a man, you can do it with, you know, a few women, sorry. You can do it with another man. Or if you want to be a woman and you want to do it with a man, that's okay too. If you're a woman, you want to be a man, you want to do it with another woman, that's all right too. The criteria is you don't harm anyone. To put very restrictive rules on people that are unnatural is very difficult. Very, very difficult. To put restrictive rules on people that they can't carry out right now is very unnatural. When we take the refuge vows, it says no sexual misconduct. What does that mean? That means sexual conduct that would harm another being. So therefore, there's no fear about taking vows about no sexual misconduct. No. Why? It didn't say you can't engage in or that. But how? So when you take the Buddhist vows, you say you don't lie. What's so hard about that? Which of us is lying all the time? There's nothing hard about that. Nothing at all. Then the Buddhist vow says don't kill. I mean, I don't think we have any Jack the Ripper reincarnations here, do we? I don't think so. We don't have Jack the Ripper reincarnations here. Then it says, don't create schism. I mean, look, all of us gossip a little bit here and there, don't we? We gossip about people in the office, we gossip about that person, we gossip about that guy, we gossip about why that guy's 50 and his new girlfriend is 18. We all gossip. We gossip why, if her hair is real, if it's dyed, that her chin's falling apart. I mean, we gossip all the time. We can't control that immediately, can we? But if we take a vow and we make a conscious effort, that's the beginning. Taking a vow doesn't mean after that you're a saint and you can't make any mistakes and you've got to walk the rest of your life on tiptoes on lotuses and not step in the mud. We're not like that. The whole country of Tibet with Buddhists, we lost our whole country. Why is that? Because everybody was pure and perfect? Of course not. Of course not. Definitely not. So once we take refuge, you think you have to be pure and perfect? No. But it's the beginning of you to become a better person. To make a conscious effort to take on those vows to say, I'm going to do something better with myself. When you take your vows, it is the first step to freedom. Why? Every day that you hold your vows, every single day that you hold your vows, is creating a positive potential, or let's use the ancient words, karma, to be free of the results of those vows that we hold. Example, when we don't lie anymore, people will listen to us, people will respect us, and what we say will be treasured by other people. Doesn't that feel good? So when we don't lie and we hold the vows, when we don't lie and we hold the vows, there's results. You're thinking, well, whether we hold the vows or we don't hold the vows, there's still karmic results, right? Yes, there is. But you see, most of us do not engage in negative actions such as killing and stealing. Most of us do not. We don't do things like that. So therefore, simply by existing every single day and not doing those actions, do not create any positive karma. Why is that? If by refraining from killing, we receive the result of not killing. Example, if we don't kill, we get a long life. We're reborn with a pleasant body, a pleasant appearance, appearance that attracts, an appearance that commands respect, an appearance that is pleasant in seeing. We'll get that kind of body. And that is subjective in every culture. Why? We are reincarnating in whatever culture, we're reincarnating in whatever body that would be pleasing to that culture, we're going to be there. It's not one stereotype. That's illogical. So therefore, if you're born on Mars and they have one eye and one ear, then you have one eye and one ear, you'd be beautiful there. Not here, but there. Similarly, if you go there, you'll be ugly. So my point is, from not killing, you'll have a strong body, a healthy body, a body that recovers, and a body that's attractive. Sijie chenpu sena. With charisma. Very powerful to attract. Very powerful to see. When you walk down the street, walk anywhere, people have to stare at you and look at you. You'll have that type of body for not killing. That will be the result, a direct result. A very powerful result. So therefore, if you take the vow of not killing, every day that you don't kill, you will accumulate that type of result. Whereas if you simply don't kill and you don't take the vow, you don't have any type of result. There's no resignation there. There is no designation. There is no confirmation. None. You're simply refraining. Because if simply refraining from an action created positive karma, babies must create a lot of positive karma. Parents must create positive karma. They don't kill. Herbivorous animals must create positive karma because they don't kill. No. Simply refraining from an action doesn't mean you're collecting virtue. Why? Because the intention is not there. Intention, motivation, intention, action, completion. Those four causes must be there for an action to have result. Motivation, intention, action, and confirmation. You're happy you've done it. If these are not there, it doesn't constitute an action. Similarly, if these are not there, it doesn't constitute taking a vow or getting a result. At the same time, it doesn't constitute breaking a vow. Breaking a vow must have intent, motivation, intent, action, and completion. Must be there to break a vow. So therefore, you think, oh, I want to kill a person. I'm going to kill him. I'm going to get them. I'm going to kill him. And then you plan. Then you go and kill him. You do it. You finish it. Oh, I'm very happy now. Then your vow is broken. If you're driving down the street and you were careless for a moment and you ran over someone and you killed them, I'm sorry to use example. You didn't break your vow. Intention, motivation, action, completion is not there. You don't break your vow. During Buddha's time, there was a fabulous nun who was a great practitioner, a great meditation master. And she attended Buddha's talk. She sat with the Sangha just like every other Sangha, ordained person. And she didn't reside in a monastery, in a nunnery. She resided in a cave. And she went there for meditation. But unfortunately, a group of bandits went there, invaded her cave, and raped her. And so when she attended the teachings the next day after that, she was still able to attend. Some of the other monks told her she can't sit up there with them. And she said, why not? They said, you're disrobed because you've engaged in intercourse. So the Buddha intervened and asked her in front of the Sangha and the people there attending for teachings, did you intend that? She said, no. When they engaged in the action, were you happy your vows are broken? She said, no. And after, when it was finished, did you think in your mind, oh, I wish to do that again? She said, no. Then Buddha says, you didn't break your vow. You are a nun. Please remain seated and attend the talks. So the other monks get quiet. So what am I trying to say? Is to break a vow or to take a vow, motivation or intent, action, completion must be all there. If it is not there, it doesn't constitute breaking a vow. Doesn't constitute. But that doesn't mean, oh, just because you're habitually inclined, so therefore you can keep on your habituations and never change yourself and never transform yourself at all, and you simply keep on doing what you've been doing before refuge, same after refuge. And that's not very good. So people are afraid of refuge or taking vows because they're afraid of challenging and pushing themselves to another level. They're very afraid of that. And what I want to tell people is, don't be afraid to challenge yourself. Don't be afraid to push yourself to another level. We all need an impetus. Sometimes we need a religious doctrine. Sometimes we need a teacher. Sometimes we come across a prayer. Sometimes we read another person's life story that's very inspiring. Sometimes it could be our very precious mothers. Sometimes it could be a school teacher that becomes an impetus for transforming ourselves. I'm not saying only by religious vows you can become a better person, no. But universally, religion is respected mostly, and religious vows are respected still in this world. Therefore, religious vows are more easier to associate with transformation. So therefore, if you don't have religious vows, it doesn't mean you cannot transform. Of course you can transform. Of course you can. But as I said, because religious vows are more associated with transformation, it's more easier to associate transformation with these vows. What are the vows for? The vows are a direct attack for our habituations. Our habituations are the causes of our imprisonment, are the causes of our suffering. All habituation. So therefore, what we need to learn first is, and this is in relation to vows, imputed objects are imputed. Imputation means something that doesn't exist on its own side. It exists from our side, but not from its own side. That is called imputation. An imputed phenomenon or an imputed object. For example, a horn on a rabbit is an imputed object. It does not exist. It does not exist at all. To say it exists, to draw it in pictures, and to make stories about it, and then scare children with it, say, oh, you know, if you're very naughty, this horned rabbit's going to come and poke you and hurt you and bite you. That fear from a child arises from an imputated phenomenon that does not exist on its own side. So when you explain to the child, hey, there's no such thing. There's this artist, and he was a very good, he had good imagination, and he just made that up, and someone else came along and made that story to scare kids, and you're a kid, you got scared, so you don't have to be scared anymore. There's no such thing. And then you show them encyclopedias of rabbits. There's not one rabbit with a horn. You take them to the zoo. To the pet shop, there's no horn. So the fear of the child goes away. Why? He realizes that it's not real. Similarly, when we have a vision of someone, or we have an idea someone is greedy or selfish or not nice, it's an imputation. Why is it an imputation? If that person was inherently not nice from their side, they would have no friends, no one would like them at all. Every single person has a friend. Similarly, if we focus on this imputation, whether it is correct or not is not the point. What the point is this, is that we habituate ourselves to react with such a person in such a manner, again and again and again and again and again. This habituated action is our prison. Why? It will only become bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. Pretty much it will envelop people we love. Pretty much it will envelop people that we care about. Pretty much it will envelop everyone we come near. And that's the fear. Does anybody have any questions on that? It's a slightly advanced topic. Does anybody have any questions on that? Maybe I pick on a few people and ask questions then, since everybody understands. See, when I say that, everybody looks down. So since everybody understands that, maybe I'll ask a few questions. And then let me look for a victim. I look at people who don't look at me. Everybody like... Let me ask. Let's ask Kendra Roshi. Taking responsibility. Is that inherently, not taking responsibility, is that inherently negative or not? It's a trick question, so be careful. He's a PhD holder, so let's see how smart he is. I don't know, in the arts or something. He looks at old paintings and blows the dust off. See, he's thinking. He loves trick questions, challenges his mind. We're waiting here, we're aging.
Yes.
You gotta turn it on, off, oh, it's on, yes. Come out of the jungle, huh? All right.
Yes.
Surprising deep voice. Okay, why?
Well, when we do an action, we create the results of it whether we own it or we don't own it.
Okay.
But if we're confronted, we must own our action. So if we're confronted and we say, oh no, but I didn't, and then, you know, then other things result.
Is habitual, is there a difference between habitual irresponsibility and irresponsibility?
No, because doesn't it go in the cycle, it comes back and reinforces, it becomes the situation.
So if you don't know something and you're irresponsible, it's the same as if you know it and it's habitual, correct?
Yes.
Incorrect. So if you've been transported to somewhere in Africa and you're living in a hut and you're supposed to get the water from the river 50 kilometers away and you didn't do that, and you didn't know you had to do that because you're looking for the faucet, and then they say you're irresponsible. Are you? Do you collect the karma of being irresponsible?
No, you have to.
Do you collect the karma of being irresponsible means pushing your weight on someone else and letting other people do something for you that you're supposed to do and you don't care about the pain it creates them? Maybe double the work or double the time. So unknowing irresponsibility and a habitual irresponsibility, is there a difference?
Well, if you break a law, you suffer the consequences whether you know or you didn't know, you still have to.
No. Unknowing irresponsibility. and knowing and habitual irresponsibility? Is there a difference? Yes. What is the difference?
Because you were never taught what is right or wrong.
Very good. And the other one is habitual irresponsibility.
You know, you do it again.
Correct. And habitual irresponsibility and unknowing irresponsibility is both harmful to the receiver. It is both harmful. Yes. Which one would be more severe?
The knowing, the habitual
Correct.
One.
And why is habitual irresponsibility and unknowing irresponsible negative? Why does it incur negative result? Why?
Because it still causes harm.
Correct. Harm on what basis?
On the basis of the person you harm.
On the basis of a person who can feel harm.
Yes.
Correct. So therefore, there's a difference between habitual irresponsibility and unknowing irresponsibility, correct? And it has negative karmic repercussions, correct? It has negative repercussions on what basis?
On the basis the other person is able to be harmed.
Correct. Another being is able to be harmed. If there's not another being that can be harmed, and it's habitual or unknowing irresponsibility, is there still negative karma?
No.
Everybody agree? Who agrees, raise your hand. Who doesn't agree, raise your hand. Some of you don't have hands. Okay. The vote is everybody like. Okay, my conclusion, some of you don't have hands. Miss Mustang there didn't raise her hand. You can raise your feet, it's all right. I like her, she's quite cute. She helps Mustang, so I call her Miss Mustang. Isn't that nice? The lady helper of Mustang. How nice. Our little Taro. What was the question? I forgot. Getting a little hot and itchy. What was the question? I forgot. You forgot too.
If there's no object to be harmed,
there's no receiver of the object of our irresponsibility. Is there still negative karma accrued from being irresponsible, either intentional or unintentional? Unknowing. Is there still negative karma that arises from that?
Yes.
But you said no.
I've changed my mind. Upon
reflection. Do you change your hairstyle upon reflection in the mirror? No. Some things you don't reflect. Okay. We like your hair. Tell me the difference. How is it when there's no recipient of harm of your irresponsibility, there's still negative karma that's accrued? How?
Because you created action that you have to suffer the result.
But there's no one to receive that action, so how do you have to suffer? So if I slap you or I slap the curtain, the karma is the same?
But you're...
My motivation is to hurt a curtain?
No, you reinforce the imprint in your mind.
What's the imprint? My mind's hurt curtains.
No, to let your anger out.
Okay. So if I slap a curtain,
and if there's an environmental, if a person's standing there, it might arise again.
Excellent. Now, therefore, whether there's an obvious living conscious recipient, I'm not talking about a plant, a conscious recipient that can feel pain, and you are irresponsible to them, either it's intentional or not, there's still karma. Correct? But if there's not a living recipient and you're still irresponsible, you still collect negative karma, correct? Why? Because who are you harming now?
Self.
That's right. How do you harm yourself when there's no outer recipient of your irresponsibility? How do you harm yourself?
Because you reinforce in your mind.
What are you reinforcing?
The imprint.
Okay. So if you reinforce the imprint in your mind, why is that negative? Why is that harmful?
Because if the right environmental cause comes along, you'll react in that way.
Whether, that's right. So therefore, if we are irresponsible, whether it is knowing or unknowing, there are still karmic repercussions. Which one will be heavier?
Well, knowing.
Why knowing heavier?
Because of your intention.
What are the two factors that arises from that? You've mentioned it already. It's negative because A and B, only two factors.
Your motivation?
No. The person that's receiving the harm, okay. And your reinforcement, that when you're reinforced, you'll harm more in the future. You understand? So therefore, knowing intentional irresponsibility is harmful. Unknowing, unintentional irresponsible is always harmful. Why? Because unknowing will lead to knowing if it's not stopped. So a person who is irresponsible and creates harm, setbacks, not following deadlines, not falling in with other people, and is harming them. When it harms them, and it's intentional, that creates negative karma. Correct? So therefore, if a person views an irresponsible person in a negative way, is that subjective or objective? Why is that subjective? The person is irresponsible.
But you don't know. I mean, you haven't looked deeper. Maybe you don't know.
Okay, we hang around with a person, go out with them for a year.
But isn't that you're imputing again?
Yes. At my level, I have only evidence to impute on. But from the side, for the sake of argument, from the person's side, that's irresponsible. Do they not create a greater harm because they allow other people to increase their imputation? So even if they do nothing and they just sit there and look pretty, do they not harm people around them? So therefore, a person who has vows to be responsible, and they're not responsible and they break their vows, just by not doing anything, is very harmful. It's the biggest harm. Why? They allow other people to increase their imputation and their holdings and their negative use. And they don't let them practice. That's why people who break their vows, they're expelled from the monasteries. Do you understand?
Yes.
That's how we learn in the monasteries. We interact and we talk. We examine. We don't just sit and lecture. We actually challenge and think. Sometimes we'll take this side. Sometimes we'll take this side. Sometimes we'll just take this side. It's called debate. We have to challenge. Why? When you challenge and you debate it out, just like Kendra Rohit and I just did, when you have come to a clear understanding, then from that is born faith. From faith comes practice and transformation. Practice is application of what you have learned. Comes transformation. And the transformation will be firm and strong and irrevocable. Cannot go backwards when it's based on sound observation and knowledge. That's exactly how we do it in the monasteries. Much more complicated, of course. And very fast. Very, very fast. You have to go back and forth, back and forth. So therefore, very good, Kendra, very good. Therefore, from the side of the person imputing irresponsibility, from the side, you're not finished, dear. Taking a breather, wiping off the sweat, passing the mic to Sumin. He ain't over yet. Did you like him? Well, that was my fun. Scratching your hair again. I told you should be Tibetan. Wash it more than once a week, please. Kendra is very Tibetan. He's a reincarnation of a Tibetan. What? I don't know about Tibetan. So did you like Cleveland? A lot?
Yes.
More than Kuala Lumpur? We're waiting. Hurry up, we're waiting. I'm sweating now.
It's different. It's different.
Oh, that's very diplomatic. More than Kuala Lumpur? Hurry up, come on, we want to move on.
Some some ways.
We got a traitor in the house. There's a traitor in the house. I don't want to tell anybody to do anything to this foreigner, but let's get him afterwards. There's a traitor in the house. You like Cleveland? And more than Kuala Lumpur. Cleveland?
Hard to believe.
You what? No, from you it's not hard to believe, but it's all right. Well, we hope nothing ugly happens to you over there. We'll pray. We hope you'll find peace in yourself over there. But I think other people will be finding you over there, but never mind. You'll understand the deeper meaning of that later. I'm a Tibetan saint. I know things that people don't know, see? Anybody believe me? Nobody believes me. They're like, yeah, right. Now, before I continue, let's take a stretch. Raise your hands. Stand up, stretch your legs. Some of you, if you can still stand up. Pass him a microphone. Put the chair on.
We are always talking about cause and effect. So, where the cause has started first?
Very good question. Any more questions? Yes, pass the microphone. Stretch out. Stretch out.
Let's say that we have taken the vow and we accidentally break it. We need to realize that we broke it. What is the proper course of action other than to repent and try not to break this vow again? Other than that, is there anything else we should do to make up for the broken vow?
Good questions. Questions. Especially for people taking vows, please ask your questions. Don't not ask your question and email me you got a question. I won't answer. Ask now. Yes. Microphone. Are you sure that thing around your neck's not edible? Looks delicious. Yes.
What is the significance of the actual ceremony as opposed to just saying taking the vows from your heart? Or in front of a statue?
It is a very good method for Tibetan lamas to extort money. Okay, questions? Any more questions? Yes, yes.
What if you have termites in your house? Do you kill them or?
You let them take over the neighborhood. Questions? Questions? Yes, with this gentleman here. Microphone, yes.
Do we have to strictly not jibrish the 50 stanza of the Guru devotion?
Oh no. We'll ask that in a little while. That one's easy. But good question. Questions? Anyone and also people taking vows? Nice, nice. Questions? Come, don't be shy. Never mind what other people think. Why never mind? Because you need to get knowledge. Ego has to be sacrificed. Questions? Yes, yes, ask. Oh, have her ask.
That's what I was going to ask about ego. Ego has to be dealt with before you can take your vows, correct?
Very good. So your question is, how come you're taking vows before you can deal with the ego? If you take your vow, right, and you have an ego, your question is, you can break them. Very good question. I'll answer it more in detail, but to give you very simply like this, if you have cancer, you'll have to take cancer medication. If you don't have cancer, you won't take cancer medication.
I'll get to it. Questions? Maggie, is it? You have questions?
Call it Bhaktis.
Kanda Rohi's sister, yes. Okay, deep dharma inside. Microphone on, off, on. Finish talking, off. Very deep. Remember that initiation. Go ahead.
How wrong is one day one cockroach invade my house?
About what? Say that.
How about if one day one cockroach invade my house?
One cockroach. Well, if you like protein, eat it.
No way. So steaks.
Questions, please. Quick, somebody ask a question. Quick. You're a DMT, is it? Okay. But yes, yes, miss.
I want to ask if I take refuge to my root guru like you, what is my commitment to you? I mean, other than taking the vows.
You have to give me 3 massages a day. You have to give me 15% of all your earnings. You have to come and massage my scalp once a week. You have to clean my toenails, and they're nasty, once a month. And when I throw a BF, you just smile and say, you're right. I'm just kidding. Just kidding, I'll explain. Good, good questions. These are good questions. These are good. These are very good questions. I'll answer it all together. Questions? Some people, when you say you got questions, you give them the microphone, they're like... And then when they leave, they don't understand anything. Questions. Isn't this more fun when we can ask, instead of having some weirdo on the throne telling you that you have to listen to him? Ask questions. I'm referring to myself as the weirdo, not the other great Tibetan lamas. So don't take it wrong. Questions? Koki, have you been going to the gym? You look slim down. Oh, you're behind the pillar, sorry. You were half covered, so it was deceptive. I imputed you lost weight. Questions? Actually, I just want to tell someone that I like Wyoming's glasses. They don't have to be shy just because I mentioned it. Questions? Any questions? Okay. Can anyone answer me? Does a fully enlightened being, like the Buddha, need to take any vows? Buddha needs to take a vow. Shakyamuni take vow. Okay, I speak Cantonese. Guang Qing, Guang Guang Guang. I don't understand. Sorry, I make up my own languages. You should hear me speak Tibetan, it's even horrible. Tibetan lamas go, why? I have an American accent speaking Tibetan. Okay. Can anybody answer me? Does Shakyamuni need to take vows? Just pass the microphone to Shin. And if you don't answer well, we got Pandora here as a backup. Well, I don't know if we like him anymore because he's a traitor.
Yes. Buddha doesn't need to take vow because they have purified their karma.
So what is a proper recipient of a person who needs to take a vow? What's a proper recipient or a person that should take a vow?
It's a person who still has negative karma to purify.
Okay. If they have negative karma to purify, why do they need to take a vow? Why would that help them to purify it?
Because that would be the cause to stop it from the cause.
How is that the cause for it to stop it?
Because, negative karma is the effect of something that you have done.
Okay.
So there must have been a cause. So for example, like you say, a healthy body, that is the effect of not killing. So not killing is the cause. So for example, you have negative karma.
Very good. So if you take a vow of not killing, if you take a vow of not killing and you don't kill, what's the difference in getting a good body?
Can you repeat that question?
Yes. If you take a vow of not killing, or you simply don't kill, those two results, which one will bring you a healthy body and why?
By taking a vow, then you will get back. Because you have all the...
So if you take a vow, and as a result of holding your vow of not killing, you get a healthy body, is that correct?
Yes.
You get a healthy body from refraining from killing.
Yes.
Why is that different than not taking a vow and simply not killing?
Because it's not a conscious action. It's not without the four elements that you mentioned just now.
Correct. So therefore, if the intention is not there, it does not equate results. Yes. So therefore, taking a vow creates an obvious and open and direct intent. Correct? So when you have the intent and you take the vow, by holding the vow every single day, the karmic repercussion or the karma from that would result in something that's similar to the vow. Do you agree with that? Okay, does everybody understand that? So therefore, if we have a disease, then we need to take medication. If we have a problem, we go for counseling. If we're naked, we wear clothes. If we're hungry, we eat food. Similarly, if we have ego, that's the best reason to take a vow. And the reason why is, it is a conscious, open, and direct step to battle the ego. Conscious why? Once you take the vow, if you are a conscientious person, the most people who take vows are, you will start learning, investigating, studying, contemplating on the cause of the ego, the antidote, and applying the antidote. And by holding the vow, it will be a impetus and a push from behind, because we have sworn to something very sacred of Buddha. It is sacred because it is someone that has become a fully enlightened being who can teach us the path from A to Z. At the same time, when we swear to an outer Buddha, the intent to swear to an outer Buddha is not to remain forever worshipping an outer Buddha. The intent of swearing to a Buddha or taking refuge in a Buddha is to find our internal or inside Buddha. But at this time, for us to run around to say we're looking for an internal Buddha is not possible. So if we live under a great artist, the minute we get involved with this great artist, we don't become a great artist ourselves. We have to go through training. After training, we can become a great artist. So when we come under the influence or the tutelage of a great artist, we trust a great artist, we surrender ourselves to a great artist, so whatever instructions the artist tells us to do, we will do it. Why? By surrendering to the artist, we are opening up the artist in all of us, in ourselves. Why? We have that potential, but we don't know what to do yet. We don't know how to prepare the canvas. We don't know the symmetry of the human body. We need to learn about background. We need to learn about colors and mixing, acrylics, oil, water. We need to learn the basis from all of that. So once we surrender ourselves to an artist, rather than losing freedom, we gain freedom. Why? In discovering the artist in ourselves. Similarly, how do we discover the artist in ourselves when we surrender? Because when we surrender to the tutelage of the artist, and we agree with whatever the artist, what this lady artist is teaching us, what she's teaching us, her experience, her knowledge, her art, when we learn, we become our own artist. Why? She's passing knowledge to us. So if we fight along the way, we don't do our homework, we're not respectful to her knowledge. Respectful means we just, whatever she teaches, we don't want to listen. Then we won't become an artist ourselves. And if we do, it will be a very long, long, hard journey. So, submission to a guru, when we take refuge, is not some haphazard, groupie,
hippie type of, you lose all sense of what I'm allowed to do and not allowed to do, what I can and what I cannot do. It's not that at all. When you submit to a guru, there's an outer physical practice of taking care of the guru's needs. Example, food, lodging, clothing. Why? So that the guru can focus 100% on teaching, explaining, and doing his job. But that is not really guru devotion. That is not really being devoted to the guru. If we live 100 miles away, 100 kilometers away, whatever, and we would like to help our guru, we would like to do some paperwork, we'd like to do some administrative work, and we'd like to, and our intent is there, but we can't due to geological differences. Different geographies, we're in another country, another city, we're away. It is not we're breaking our guru commitment, we're physically not able to. Since we're not physically able to, we don't break any guru commitment vows with 50 verses of guru devotion. What happens is, real guru devotion is not about massaging, giving money, giving lodging, giving food, or taking care of the guru. Those are just beginning steps that the guru uses to train up your mind. What real guru devotion is keeping your commitments. That is real guru devotion. So if you've taken higher initiations and you have to do your tok every 2 weeks and you do it, that is guru devotion. If you have sworn not to be irresponsible, to work your load and to do your load and to push your own load and to do your work and not leave it for others because it creates them to be unhappy and untrusting, and you do it, that is guru devotion. A real guru is not looking for service. A real guru is not looking for material advancement. A real guru is not looking for praise. A real guru is looking for your spiritual advancement. When you engage in your meditations, contemplations, when you engage in study and learning, when you engage in class and reading, that is guru devotion. That is. In the 50 verses of guru devotion, it says, oh, if I step on my guru's shadow, it will be very heavy consequences, like stepping on a stupa. We don't need to fear those things. We don't need to fear. Why is that there? It is to create awareness. The reason we respect our guru, the reason why we listen to our guru, and the reason why we do what our guru has taught us is not to become a slave. It is after years of checking our guru. You see, years or months or decades of checking a guru is dependent on the student's level and interaction. If the student meets the guru or the teacher once a year, it's take a few years to check out the person. It's gonna take a few years. It's not something blind. A person has a title, wears robes, or sits on a big throne doesn't mean they're a qualified person. How to distinguish a qualified teacher? If you don't have the necessities or you don't have the tools to check, if you're not a biophysicist, you cannot check out another biophysicist. But what you need to relate to is the guru kind? Is the guru patient? Does the guru speak in such a way that touches your heart? Do you feel that the instructions that the guru gives you is sound? And what the guru gives you, do you feel that you can be inspired to practice? That would be very good for someone on a level at this time. And real guru devotion is not about service. It is not about massaging or living nearby or doing this work. That is just peripheral. Real guru devotion is transforming your mind. Real guru devotion is when no one is watching you, you break your habituation and do the right thing. When someone is watching you, and to avoid embarrassment and criticism, you do the right thing. When someone is not watching you and you avoid criticism and you don't care because you've committed. And it's very hard to break your habit, but you force and you commit and you push yourself to break your habit. That is guru devotion. Why is that guru devotion? Why? Because by doing that, you go on the journey of finding the real guru in yourself. Clear, conscious, aware, focused mind. That is the reason we take a guru. That is the reason. For example, there are some teachers who teach thousands and thousands of people. There is no way that one person can have interaction with every single person in the audience. No way. But then how to check? We can listen to the other students. We can check the actions of the other students. Are the other actions of the student, are the actions of the other students kind? Are they helpful? Are they generally nice people? What's the atmosphere? We can feel by that. We all have feelings. We're very sensitive people. That's one. Number two, if we're not able to check our guru directly, then we listen to our guru's words, writings, talks, speeches, tapes, to listen to what he teaches. I'm sure many teachers have given thousands and thousands of hours of teachings on many subjects. We check that. Does it apply to us? Do we find it useful? Does it touch our heart? Does it inspire us to transform? Does it inspire us to change? And that would be all right. So, if we can be of service to our guru, it is not the person you're focusing on. People feel, when I take this person as my guru, I have to please them. I have to be a slave. I have to do whatever they say. That is not the right attitude. That's an attitude of fear. That's not the right attitude. When we take someone as our guru, when we take someone as our teacher, this person has a responsibility to share the Dharma with us. With no ulterior motive of getting something back. This person shares the Dharma tirelessly, with a lot of effort, patiently, again and again and again, with a lot of compassion and with your salvation, your benefit in mind. This is what a guru is about. A guru that studied more, has put in more hours and more years and more time into his practice and receiving the teachings, has controlled his actions by holding on to his vows. By taking a vow in front of a Buddha, when there is no teachers around, that will be all right. If there is a qualified teacher around and we take the vow from a teacher, it's more beneficial. Why? Because there's a lineage. The vow has a source. To receive a vow from a living vow holder plants the seeds in our mind to actualize those vows. By taking a vow in front of a statue or an image or a picture when no guru's around, we don't plant the seeds of activation of the vows. We only plant, what we do is we receive the vows in front of a statue, we take it because we have respect for the image of a Buddha and we believe the Buddha is there. So when we take the vows in front of a statue or image or a picture or a relic, it is only something that helps us to stop us from doing more negative karma because we have sworn. So it has the benefit of stopping the negative karma once we have sworn, but it has no benefit of activation of the seeds that has never been planted in us. You understand? So therefore, when we take the vows in front of a teacher or from a teacher that has received the vows from his teacher and his teacher and his teacher and his teacher and his teacher, and his teacher so on, and it originates back to Lord Buddha, it has a source and is valid. If we simply take it in front of a statue, an image, it stops us from doing more negative action, but it doesn't have the potential to open up seeds. Why? There has been no seeds planted in our mind. Does everybody understand that? But after we had taken the vows, after, for the case of refuge vows, all right, not other vows, I'm talking about refuge only. For the case of refuge vows, after we have taken them, if we should break it, if we should haphazardly damage it, we may go back to a Buddha image, we may go back to a Buddha picture or tanka or representation, make three prostrations, sincerely regret, apply the four opponent powers, and from the henceforth, not break it again. It has a lot of effect. So once we have taken the vows, we can retake it in front of a Buddha image, a Buddha picture, or an enlightened being. Why is that? Think carefully, because you have already taken the vows, the seeds are there. It is likened to the seed being planted in the ground. If we don't cultivate it, the seed just doesn't grow, but it doesn't die or dry away, it stays there. So maybe when the rains come, 1 year, 1 month, 10 years later, the seeds will sprout. Similarly, when the Lama gives you the vows, because he's received it from his Lama, etc., 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 you have the power of the vows because it's been passed from an authentic lineage. So once it's been passed down to you authentically, you plant it in your mind. When it's planted in your consciousness and you do the practices of holding the vows, you will reap the benefit of holding those vows. Example, not killing, not stealing. You'll reap the benefits. Simply by refraining from them, you don't collect more negative karma. You don't collect more negative karma because you're refraining, but it's likened to that of a person who simply doesn't commit negative actions, whether they've sworn or not. So swearing to a Buddha image or swearing to a Tanka without having the vows prior from a living lineage holder doesn't create any results from those vows. If we break those, if we break the vows after we have broken them, the intensity of the vows results arise from the four intent. You want to do it, premeditate, you want to do it. You do the action, you're very happy, you have no regrets. Then it's sealed. Sealed in what way? Till you purify. So when we take the vow, when we take this vow, it's very, very beneficial. Why? Because every day that you hold the vow, you also collect the virtuous, meritorious karma that it goes back to reinforcing itself. So every day that you hold the vow of not killing, it will become easier and easier and easier and easier and easier. Why? A, habituation. B, you are creating the direct cause of not killing. So in future lives, you will not be attracted to killing. You'll be not attracted to arts that kill. You'll not be attracted to beings that kill. You'll not encourage it or like it, go near it. And everybody who goes near you will be encouraged not to kill and will be changed by your non-killing peaceful stance. So instead of you being influenced by them in future lives, you will influence them not to kill as a result of holding your vows. How is that? Because the karma that arises from every day holding the vows of not killing. Similarly, when we don't lie, every single day we don't lie, we collect the merit of having the 60 qualities of perfect speech. Every single day. And in the future, dependent on our practice, our speech will be able to bring relief to other people, bring knowledge to other people, bring confidence and bring relief to other people. Why? Based on holding the vow every single day of not lying. Based on the vow of not lying every single day, we collect the vow. We collect the result of that vow. It's like putting an FD in. If you leave the FD in the bank, the interest can only accrue. Only can accrue. So therefore, taking a vow is very, very important for our Buddhist practice. Why is it important? A, we want to move ahead in our practice. We don't want to stay stagnant. We want something to push us. We want something to motivate us. We want something that makes us feel we have to do it. And what will be more important than taking vows in front of the three jewels? The actual beings that we take refuge in. I mean, most people go to the temple and they pray for things. They believe they have the power to grant things. So therefore, if we take vows in front of them, they also have the power to bless us, to hold our vows. By holding our vows well, it is training. Subconsciously, we know we have a vow. It forces us to break our habituations. Every day that we hold the vows, every day, it creates a powerful karmic result that it reinforces our vows. So we become better and better and better. And in this life, it may be a struggle to hold our vows. But if we continuously struggle, it will become spontaneous and easy. When it becomes spontaneous and easy, it becomes habitual. When it becomes habitual, every single life, you will be born into a situation where whether you hold the vows or not, you will be naturally instinctive towards virtuous action. Not killing, not stealing, not lying, not creating schism, not manipulating. You'll be naturally inclined. Why? From happy situation. Then from that, you advance in your spiritual journey. Why? Whatever religion you are, wherever you're born, you need people who have ethics. You need people who are ethical. Ethics and ethical people don't come out from nothing. They must have a cause. The cause is unethical people. Unethical people who realize that ethics is more beneficial than being unethical. And unethical ways and doing things in life brings more harm than happiness. Realizing that, we wish to be ethical, we wish to become better people. Wishing to become better people, we seek a way. We take the vows. When we take the vows, we challenge ourselves to become better. We push ourselves to become better because we have a vow to do so. And at the same time, we hold the positive, we hold the vows which create positive karma to help us reinforce. It's like forcing ourselves to put a bundle of money in the bank that could be spent on a trip, a car, or furs, or not furs, fake furs. All right, let's be politically correct. Fake furs. Wigs, bad hairdos, all types of things we can put our money toward. But if we force ourselves not to buy that car because we already have one, not to go on the trip because we went on many trips already to England in the last few months, and we save our money, we put our money away, we force ourselves to. But what happens is the money doesn't stay stagnant. It collects interest. And if we leave it there long enough, one day, the interest will be more on the same or more than the principal that we have put in. So similarly, when we take vows, we say to the three jewels, I don't want to suffer anymore. And I, after taking the vows, doesn't mean I won't suffer, but I'm starting on the path that I will not suffer anymore. Therefore, I wish to take the vows. I wish to take the vows because I don't want to suffer. I want freedom. I want to take control of my life. And I want to take my control of my life in a positive way. Not just the mental confirmation, but something that creates a positive imprint and karma that reinforces what we have sworn to. So it's very important. The 50 verses of Guru devotion, I will not go into now. Last week I gave 27 hours worth of teachings, 3 days, it was 9 hours a day. On that one I gave intensive talk for modern day Guru devotion. For modern day people who want to take a teacher, but not necessarily can follow a teacher like it says in the book, what they did 500, 600, 1,000 years ago. 1,000 years ago, you lived in a village, you lived in a straw hut, no electricity, no water, no airplanes, no motor vehicles, no trains, no planes, nothing. You hang out in your village, you work the fields, and then when you have free time, you go and help your teacher. It's very easy to do all that. It's not easy now. There are so many things that distract us. So therefore, for modern people who need to advance spiritually, they need to find a Dharma teacher. There's only so much you can learn in a book. So therefore, for those people, I gave a special set of talks that is based on the 50 verses of Guru devotion, condensed into the 9 attitudes toward a Guru, and then I condensed that some more into modern day practices for people. So for people who are very interested in that, I would recommend you to get that CD or VCD, I don't know what it's on, to listen to it. It would be very, very beneficial for you, very, very beneficial. But know, what's in that book, you use logic. You use a conscience. If you're a Vietnam War veteran, you have no legs, and your guru walks in, you can't stand up, what do you collect bad karma? Of course not. But the book says, if your guru walks in, you don't stand up, it's bad karma. Come on, use your brain. Use your brain. So if you go on a picnic with your guru, right? And you got, and your guru and you and the group is playing Ring Around the Rosie and you're dancing around singing Om Mani Padme Hum songs, and you step on the guru's shadow, then you go to hell? So how to play Ring Around the Rosie? Logic. Logic. Standing up when your guru comes in. Not stepping on guru's shadow. walking behind, offering dreams, taking care. Those are practices for you to start your awareness. Why most of us are not aware of other people and their needs and how we treat them and what we do. We knock them over, we step on them, we throw their things here and there, we're not responsible. When we practice guru devotion, it is to someone that has taught us the Dharma and the path to spiritual enlightenment. So we treasure this person very much. By showing respect to this person, we are showing respect to all sentient beings. Why? If we are already an aware person, those practices, 50 verses of guru devotion, is very easy. If we're not an aware person, it becomes very, very hard. Why? Not to sleep in front of your guru. I mean, that's one of the vows, not to twist your body around, not to crack your knuckles, not to burp and fart, not to point your legs at your guru, not to fall asleep. I mean, why would we do that to anybody, not just our guru? Why? Why would we want to sleep in front of someone when they're talking? They're talking away, you're in front. I mean, that's already bad karma, don't you think? And if someone's sitting in front of you and talking, and you're sitting there, you're doing this, and you're doing that. I mean, isn't that common sense? Isn't that? So if you're walking down the street, not to step on your guru's shadow, now it's not a matter you step on your shadow and then you go to hell. It's more awareness so you don't step on his toe and knock him over or push him. I mean, how do you walk with people in malls or places where they're always knocking you over or they're pushing you or they're stepping in front of you or they, you know, you're trying to walk this way, they're walking this way, you're like that, and then you're like that, like that, like that. How do you come across people like that? Who is dropping things, who is always knocking things over? Why? It's funny at first, and it's funny when Mr. Bean does it. But when you have to live with it, it's not funny. When you have to deal with it with people around you, it's not funny to have people always falling, knocking things over, dropping things, hitting things, forgetting things, stepping on your toe, stepping on your pets. It's not fun, is it? So what is that? It's to create awareness. If we can start being aware with our guru, if we can start being aware with our guru, we start awareness. And once we're aware with this person, we don't have to only be aware with only gurus, we can apply this awareness to everybody around us. Every person that comes in contact with us. And therefore, what is created from the devotion to the guru of awareness is the aware mind. And we can apply that to everybody. So would that be nice? So if we're around our guru, and he's taught us the holy Dharma, we respect him so much, we teach ourselves to sit correctly. Then once we teach ourselves to sit correctly, the next person we're with, we sit correctly, we sit nicely. It's very pleasant. That's what guru devotion is about. Guru devotion is not about you do something bad to the guru and you go to hell. It's about awareness. And every time you make a mistake, you feel bad because you've let your old habits slip again. You let your old habits slip again. So if you're used to sitting there talking with people, and you're used to burping or sucking your teeth, don't you hate when you hang around people, they say, like some kind of musical instrument with their teeth. Doesn't that bother you? Well, when we're near our guru, we're not supposed to do that. We're not supposed to do that because it's rude. It's very bad manners. And we allow ourselves to do that with everybody we go. So pretty much we'll go anywhere. Hey, Mr. Prime Minister. It's not that we want to, we just start doing that. Out of habit. So, not twisting and wringing our body around. Not spitting and coughing in front of our guru. Not letting out gas in front of our guru. It's not that you will go to hell, it is to help you to have some sort of awareness and control. Now, if you have a cold, you're sneezing away, then you just cover yourself. I mean, do you like to hang around a person, achoo, and you're taking a shower with their saliva? I don't. So if we start with our guru, we can get this practice out everywhere. So we don't need to worry about infringements of these small things that we break. What it's about awareness. It's about awareness. And most important is, more important than those small little things, is if our teacher gives us a practice, our teacher has examined us, has listened, has heard, has checked, and has given us a special practice to do. And And when our teacher gives us a special practice to do, it is molded and customized for us. It is molded and customized for us, especially for us. So we respect our teacher and we have guru devotion, we will be devoted to what he has told us to do, and we will complete it. So if our guru sees that, you know, we're 90 years old, and we can barely, you know, walk across the floor, and we're already dragging ourselves, our guru is not going to be some insane mental maniac saying, oh, you have to do 100,000 prostrations. And if you don't do it, you go to hell. But I want to do it. But you can't. That's not it about. But if your body is fit and you're all right, and then the guru tells you to do 100,000 prostrations and you don't, and you make up all types of lame excuses to cover and procrastination and stuff, then you're not devoted to your guru. You're not devoted to your guru. If you're not devoted to your guru and you can't even respect the person that teaches the Dharma, that takes care of you and gives you knowledge, if you can't even respect that, definitely this person will not respect other people. And if this person doesn't respect other people, they don't listen to other people, or they don't try to do things for other people, what type of life do you think this person will have? Happiness? Peace? Grounding? Harmony? Openness? Or fear? Or cover? Or lies? Or excuses? And when they do that, they increase their ego. So when we don't listen to our guru, especially for Dharma practice, especially, it is a cause for us to increase our ego. And those people who break their guru devotion commitments, you will see very clearly the ego is very big. I want to win is very big. Lying becomes very incessant. Covering becomes incessant. Why? Because they always have to cover what they've broken. It's very simple.